The human cost of Russia's war on Ukraine. Hundreds of thousands of refugees stream into Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and other countries. Can they handle the influx? And will the crisis change the way the EU deals with migration? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. Beyond the tanks, missiles, and political wrangling over Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it's the people who are paying the price. The war has created a major humanitarian crisis in Eastern Europe. The UN's refugee agency believes at least 368,000 people have escaped Ukraine to neighboring countries. Many have crossed into Poland, with thousands more arriving in Hungary, Romania, Slovakia, and Moldova. The UNHCR is preparing for up to 4 million refugees if the conflict drags on. Most of the new arrivals are women and children, as Ukrainian men up to 60 years old have been told to return and join the fight. Volunteers and NGOs are doing what they can to help, as Zain Bazravi reports from a train station in eastern Poland.
Beyond the reaches of the Russian army, refugees from Ukraine arrive in the safety of Poland. Forced to take only what is most important, only what they can carry. Here, friendly faces, open arms, and as much comfort as can be had, sheltering in a train station. Vladimir Szymanski was working in the Netherlands when the war broke out. He's waiting for his five sons to arrive from across the border to take them to safety. He'll then return to Ukraine, where he says he will join his wife, a soldier in the National Army. Ukrainians are prepared to die, he says, before ever surrendering their country to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I can say when Ukrainians lose, Europa is going to be next one. Poland and all Europa and maybe America too. So help us or it's going to be the same like Ukraine.
Ukraine's decision to conscript men of fighting age into the armed forces has divided families. The women who have fled with their children know that long goodbyes may turn out to be final farewells. But there is resilience here.
My daughters always try to have some fun. They can find fun and somewhere and everywhere if they have some toys. But older girl feel that dangerous situation, but we try to be strong, to not so panic.
For many of the displaced, the Shemeshla train station will be the first time any of them have seen any sort of help in days. A hot meal, a place to rest, rides to cities across Europe, even people opening up their own homes to offer those displaced by the fighting in Ukraine a place to stay. There has been an outpouring of support from volunteers who want to help any way they can. We met Maria in tears as she searched for a mother with a newborn she had met earlier in the day. She came back to the train station with toys, but the mother and baby are gone.
I'd gladly bomb Putin to England and the US and other countries, just get dozens of planes to bomb him. That's all I want to say.
There is solidarity with Ukrainians and anger at Russia. As Europe's latest refugees try to figure out what to do next, desperate for news from the people they left behind. Those that made it out of Ukraine have a warning for the rest of the world. Millions of lives are at stake. Help stop Russia while you still can. Zain Basravi, Al Jazeera, Przemyśl, Eastern Poland.
All right, let's bring in our guests. In Kharkiv, in Ukraine, Maria Avdiva, head of research at the European Expert Association. In Geneva, Jung Ah Gedini Williams, head of global communications at United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And in Paris, Ole Solvang, director of partnerships and policy at the Norwegian Refugee Council. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Maria, let me start with you. What's the situation like for you in Kharkiv right now, and how concerned are you about how dire the humanitarian situation could grow in the days ahead?
Well, for the past three days, we have been going through shellings, and yesterday they got strong, and during the night the shellings continued, and today in the morning we've got reports that Russian troops on light vehicles have managed to enter the city in small groups, and the Ukrainian military started the operation inside the city. So on the streets fighting were going, and there were a lot of shootings all over the place and in the city, and the explosions. Also, the Russians during this night, they exploded the gas pipeline in Kharkiv. We also have reports that there are deaths among civilians, and one of the missiles got into the building, full-story building with people there. So the situation is really threatening. People spend the night today in shelters or in the underground, which is used as a shelter for now. It seems that Kharkiv is under control of Ukraine. It seems that Russian forces did not expect that they will see such a intense fighting and resistance from Ukrainian citizens and Ukrainian military. So they were pushed back. Those vehicles that entered the city were destroyed. So Russian forces are now again on the previous positions near the city. But the threat is very close, and actually now the shelling starts again, and we understand that it might continue and get bigger again in the night. I was spoken to the neighbors in my place where I live yesterday, and went to the grocery shop to see if there is anything left. So people are really anxious and are really frightened about the situation, especially those with small children. And they spend the nights in basements and in the shelters, and during the day as well, going there several times. In the grocery shops, there are no fresh products. I mean, bread, milk, and such kind of things. But anyway, that people are still have some sufficient supplies, so there's no crisis with that yet at the moment. And my fear is that Russia, seeing that it cannot, so that Ukraine is not surrendering, and the Ukraine fights back fiercely, they will try to use saboteurs to blow up or explode some infrastructure objects in the city, because we have seen numerous reports today from Kyiv that Kyiv military have captured the saboteurs carrying explosion in their backpacks, tried to do it in some very important objects inside the city.
Junga, let me ask you first, how is the humanitarian response going inside Ukraine right now? Has UNHCR and have UNHCR teams been able to access people in need inside Ukraine?
Well, as you can imagine, the situation there is extremely fluid, extremely precarious. We've been in Ukraine for over 30 years, and we've been running an emergency operation there since 2014. But as with everybody else in terms of the civilian population, the UNHCR staff in Kyiv is of course, bunkered down as well. We are still continuing, where we can, our humanitarian aid deliveries. So yesterday, we were able to get a truckload of supplies out to internally displaced people in central Ukraine. However, many parts of the country are completely inaccessible. So we are really calling on access and security for humanitarian agencies like UNHCR so that we can go out there and deliver urgently needed life-saving assistance to anyone who is forced to flee right now.
Ole, from your vantage point, how massive will the humanitarian needs be? And are the humanitarian actors who are responding to this crisis scaled up enough right now to be able to deal with it appropriately?
I think from what it looks like at this point, I think the humanitarian needs will be absolutely massive. You know, before this recent escalation of hostilities, there were 3 million people in Ukraine who was in need of assistance. And I think what's also important to remember here, and kind of a unique thing about Ukraine, is that so many of those people were actually elderly. 30% were elderly, and many of them living along the sort of old front lines here. I think we are, together with many other humanitarian organizations, very ready to scale up, and we're now looking at how to scale up our plans, both within Ukraine, but also in the neighboring countries. What we do need is commitments from our partners, from our donors, to finance those operations. And as my colleague from UNHCR just said, what we really need is also safety and security on the ground, and that the conditions on the ground are such that we are able to deliver that in a safe way. So that is what we're hoping for.
Maria, what you described to me in your earlier answer, it sounds absolutely terrifying for those like yourself on the ground there in Kharkiv and in other parts of Ukraine. You were talking about essentially the people paying the price for all of this right now. And I want to ask you, based on what's going on, do you feel that you, your family members, your loved ones should leave?
Well, I myself am not going to leave anywhere, because I'm determined to stay here in Kharkiv as much as possible, because I want to defend my home and my city. It's where I was born. I don't want to become refugee just because Mr. Putin doesn't like Ukraine and wants to have control over our country. That will not happen. And now everyone counts. I can help in the way I do. I'm, for example, now doing and go giving up information to the world about what is going on, so everyone knows that the war crimes are being now made by Russia to Ukraine. And but if there will be also other help that I could provide, for example, giving some medical aid or volunteer, and that I will be ready for that as well. So I'm staying here. The family of with elderly members are, so they left Kharkiv, but everyone who is now in Kharkiv, they are ready to fight, because that is our land, and we don't want to let anyone come here and say us Ukrainians what to do.
Jung Ah, when it comes to this displacement crisis, the numbers that we're already talking about are absolutely staggering. I mean, just in the last several hours, I've seen UNHCR publicizing the fact. First, it was 150,000 refugees from Ukraine had arrived in neighboring countries. Then just a couple of hours after that, it was 368,000 Ukrainian refugees arriving in neighboring countries. UNHCR is saying that they are projecting that up to 4 million people could flee Ukraine. Can countries like Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and others, can they actually handle this influx?
I think right now what we're seeing is across the board tremendous hospitality, solidarity, and a welcome for any Ukrainians that are forced to flee. And that's throughout the entire region. And I'm not just talking about the governments. People are literally opening their homes, collecting supplies for infants, for mothers, for elderly people. So I think we are seeing a tremendous outpouring of support. However, as you mentioned, we are estimating that up to 4 million could flee. That is a huge number. We'll have to see, of course, in the coming days, how we reinforce. We have, along with other humanitarian agencies, stockpiles both inside and outside Ukraine. But the needs are going to be staggering. And we're already seeing that we will have to reinforce everything that we have on the ground. And then in terms of your question about the ability to uphold all these needs, I think what Maria just said is a key point, which is all the Ukrainians that we are speaking to that are arriving in Poland, Moldova, Romania, Hungary, they're all stressing that they want to stay close to home. They have loved ones inside. They have their homes. They have their lives. They have pets. They have everything that they've been forced to leave behind. as soon as they think that it's possible for them to go back, they want to go back. So I don't think people generally want to move further afield right now. They want to be able to go back to their homes and their lives as soon as they're able to do so.
All right, I just want to step back for a moment and look at another angle of all of this. African students trying to leave Ukraine are denouncing Ukrainian and Polish authorities on social media. Videos posted on Twitter show large crowds of young people of African descent stuck at the border since the invasion began. Take a look.
These are the black communities. We are not allowing any black people to enter inside the gates. We are all here. It's only Ukrainians that they are allowing in. Even the ones with kids,
they're not allowing them in. They really have been here
for days, and nobody's asking any questions. Only Ukrainian woman and kids they're allowing in through this gate. All the places blocked, and all are full of blacks from different communities, from different countries. Nobody's talking to us.
Poland's response now is very different to last year when soldiers stopped thousands of mainly Syrian, Afghan, and Kurdish refugees crossing over from Belarus. It's also in contrast to how European nations dealt with more than 1 million refugees who entered during the 2015 migrant crisis. Ole, let me ask you about this. I'm struck by the fact that the response is so different right now. I spent a lot of time in Europe in 2015 covering the refugee crisis. And one of the borders that I spent a lot of time was the Serbian border with Hungary. And I saw refugees mainly from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, other countries that were forced back into Serbia by patrolmen on horses. A lot of these refugees, men, women, and children, were beaten back. They were injured when trying to come in to Hungary. And, of course, there's been a lot of controversy these past several years about the EU's migration policy. When you see how different the response is right now to refugees from Ukraine, who obviously should be given safe harbor, but when you see how different the response is to the refugees from Ukraine to what the actions were when it was refugees coming from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries, what do you make of that?
Well, I think this is something that we need to reflect over. And I think, you know, this is it's an incredibly important principle in international law that anybody who is in need of safety should receive it where they might be able to get it. And this has been the position of the Norwegian Refugee Council as well in these last several years, as we have seen people from other places, around the world seeking refuge in Europe, is that we have to let those with real protection need in and to make sure that they are safe as well. It is, as you say, a very conspicuous difference here in terms of how European countries have reacted to these different situations. But what I hope, perhaps, is that we can take with us kind of some of the lessons or reflections from this crisis in Ukraine and how we have responded to that, so that we also can have more empathy for people who are coming from other parts of the world, and that we see. I hope that we will see a more open attitude to those people as well going forward.
Jung, the German Interior Minister has said that Europe should agree on accepting Ukrainian refugees without bureaucratic hurdles. From your perspective, from your point of view, do you think that this crisis may change the way that the EU deals with migration going forward?
It's very possible. I mean, obviously, it's early days and things are just changing, not only daily, but hourly. But I do think that we do have precedents in other situations. During the Bosnian conflict, for example, during the Kosovo conflict, we did have situations where with the conflict in Europe, different European countries did come to agreements on how many refugees they would accept, and also what would be the rights and the services that they would be allowed. So already, I think that these discussions are taking place. We're glad that they're taking place sooner rather than later. But I think right now it's humanitarian access and humanitarian aid that is the most important need on the ground.
Maria, when you speak to friends of yours, colleagues in Ukraine who have made that extremely difficult and traumatic decision to leave, what are they telling you? Are they telling you that they believe they will only be gone a short time, or do they fear that this could last a very long time and that they could be away from home for much longer than they had anticipated?
Well, most of my friends and colleagues who have to leave their homes because some of them did want to stay, so they went to places inside Ukraine, to the west of Ukraine, to the central Ukraine. That is still not safe there because Russia shells also that areas as well. But still, it is, of course, safer than, for example, in Kharkiv now or in Kyiv. And what they want is they want to come back as soon as possible to their homes, to return to their normal lives, because we are a big nation of 40 million people. We don't want, you know, to run. We want to fight, and we want to have control over Ukrainian territory, which is according to the international laws. So I have myself been offered many times by my friends a place where I could stay in Poland, in Germany, in Macedonia, in Moldova, in other countries, because now everyone here is given hand to Ukraine, and European nations are united in this. So I was offered that help, and I'm really thankful to all of those who help Ukraine now. But as I have said, I do not want to leave because I don't have any reasons for that. It's Russian soldiers who have to leave our territory. And speaking of those few who have actually left and went to Poland, for example, or Moldova, they usually make this because they are really afraid and they have small children and they are threatened that if they will stay in Ukraine, even in Western Ukraine, where there are also airstrikes now, that the children can be harmed, and so they're protecting their small ones.
Ole, obviously there is great concern for the people of Ukraine, for those who are staying, for those who have decided to leave. But I want to ask you about another aspect of this. Is there concern on the part of you and your colleagues for the safety of the humanitarian workers that are responding to all of this?
Yeah, of course there is. I mean, we now have, you know, our teams from the Norwegian Refugee Council. They're in Kyiv, they're in Severodonetsk, which is a city that is fairly close to what used to be the front lines between government and non-government controlled areas. And they are hunkering down in bomb shelters as everybody else. And as we talked about, I think it is incredibly important that they are able to then, when things stabilize a little bit, work freely. But I think, you know, the most important part now for me is really to keep a focus on the civilians who are caught in this sort of unnecessary war in areas of active fighting. We saw back from 2014 and 2015 that both sides ended up using weapons that were extremely dangerous to civilians, area weapons, and we've seen confirmation of such use of weapons again now. So I'm really worried that we will see both displacement, but we'll also see much more damage to infrastructure, to houses, killings and injuries of civilians. And this is really what our focus should be on now, to try to stop that. There should be maximum diplomatic pressure to stop that, to not use such weapons. And then we need to scale up the humanitarian assistance so that we can address the needs that are going to be absolutely staggering.
It is a terrifying situation, very concerning for so many of the people inside of Ukraine right now. We have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the discussion there. Thank you so much to all of our guests, Maria Avdiva, Jung Ah, Gidini Williams, and Ole Solvang. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. from me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here. Bye for now.